No, she didn't have to turn it on yet. Watch.
We're going to open the committee meeting on rural communities and economic development. And there's a lot of people here. We have a whole lot of testimony, and we have a couple hours to spend together. So, but before that, because our issues today are really issues that really address what this committee is about, in that it really is about rural areas around our state, there are two testimonies we're going to take ahead of time by phone from across the state. So we're going to take that. So we're going to open a couple hearings for telephone testimony, and we're going to let them talk. One is coming from Louise Groomer, Chiloquin Volunteer Ambulance Service, and the other one is Gary Plant, a doctor in Madras Medical Clinic, to take their testimony first. So I'm going to open a public hearing for phone testimony on Senate Bill 324, and I'll also open the one on 325, and then we'll be able to take both of those at that time.
Hi, Louise. This is Raquel with the Senate Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee.
Hi.
And so this is Senator Roblin. I'm the chair, and it is our privilege to have you do some testimony. So I'm calling on you now to give some testimony on Senate Bill 324.
Okay. Senator Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify before the Senate Rural Committees and Economic Development Committee today. My name is Louise Groomer. I'm the business administrator for Chiloquin Volunteer Ambulance Service and an Oregon EMT intermediate. I'm also on the board of directors for the Oregon Rural Health Association as a member at large from the EMS community. I'm sorry I could not make it to Salem today to testify in person, but I'm needed here in Chiloquin to cover the ambulance response area. When SB 31 was passed in 2005, I was an EMT basic and took advantage of this tax credit, thinking what a great gesture this was for the volunteer. I'm no longer eligible for the tax credit due to my change in job description, but I'm still a strong believer and advocate of it. When we have new volunteers come to our agency, informing them about the tax credit is high on the list of unforeseen benefits of volunteering as an EMS provider. Believe me when I tell you, at times it feels like the costs greatly outweigh the benefits. To become an emergency medical responder, an EMR, takes about 50 hours of education. To become an EMT, it takes about 6 months, going to classes 2 evenings a week and every other Saturday. To keep the license, you need to attend continuing education. And to become an advanced EMT or an Oregon intermediate, the whole process repeats itself. All of this takes precious time away from family and other obligations. Our agency is able to afford to help pay the cost of the education of the EMTs. Most rural agencies cannot afford this expense, leaving the about $1,300 for school, books, and testing fees up to the volunteer. Our agency currently has 10 volunteers eligible for the tax credit. The Oregon Rural and Volunteer EMS Provider Tax Credit is very important to those volunteers. We recently started giving our volunteers a small stipend when they cover shifts, and the first question from them was, how is this money going to impact my tax credit? Fortunately, the small amount we are able to give our volunteers will not change their eligibility for the tax credit. Had that not been the case, many of the responders were willing to not receive the stipend in order to still qualify for the tax credit. The small acknowledgement and thanks in form of this tax credit from the state of Oregon for these volunteers means a lot. Of the 316 transports we did in 2012, 206 of those transports were staffed by volunteers eligible for the tax credit. These same people attend approximately 30 hours each of continuing education to maintain their license. I hope this committee will do everything in its power to move SB 324 forward. Thank you again for allowing me to testify before your committee.
Thank you, Louise. Is there any questions from our committee for Louise? Seeing none. Again, thank you very much for taking your time. We're going to say goodbye to you, and we have another call to make. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. And committee, while we're going through that, hopefully you got the little memo on tax credits, because as I hope people know, we'll do these tax credit bills, but then they have to go to the tax credit committee for final approval eventually. And they have a group of questions that they asked, liked us to ask, so as we got the information, so that they can help prioritize which ones are going to happen later on. So that's why that was sent to you. With that, we can.
Top document.
Hello, is this Dr. Plant?
I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
Uh-oh. We'll hope we have right. Thanks. We'll find out if we have the right number. 541 450 3343.
That's the wrong number.
Hi, Doug.
Doug, do you have the number? No.
541-450-3343.
That's what we have. Yeah.
Okay. We'll try it one more time. 541-450-3343.
Preface it right.
We'll figure out something. So we're going to, yeah, we'll leave them open. We can leave them all open.
Okay.
And now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 323. So we'll have all of our meetings open and we'll bring testimony as we need it. But right now, Senator Thompson, first you want to give a short explanation of the bill we're considering right now?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Point of order, are we having all three open at
no.
this point?
They are all three open now, but we will take only testimony for 323 to begin with.
Just for the record.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 323 extends the sunset date from January 1st, 2014 to January 1st, 2020 for tax credits for owners, operators, or lenders of eligible farm worker housing projects. A revenue statement has been issued and should be in front of all of you, and there is no fiscal impact.
So we can have our first panel, and Senator Chuck Thompson, Katie Koba, Roberto Jimenez, and Peter Hanley. And however you guys want, including the Honorable Senator.
Oh, Chair Roblin, who's the Vice Chair? Sherman. thanks for having me today. Just in real quick, because I'm next door. And committee, sorry.
Right.
Didn't mean to miss you, Senator Bird. Just here to testify for this.
And you are?
And who are you?
Oh, I'm Chuck Thompson. From down up the other way.
Yes.
Senate District 26, live in Hood River, and a lot of Clackamas and Multnomah County. Thank you. Thanks for having me today. Just here to testify in favor of this bill. It's been used over and over again. I'm here mainly for agricultural use, to give you an example of how we utilize this bill. We've built lots and lots of farm labor housing throughout the state. We use it a lot in Hood River County. And what we're facing in the next, the reason it's very important that we continue this for another period of time is because 2018, we have to meet certain new guidelines by federal standards, which means we have to increase our square footage per person that's in the housing. And so we're going to have to go through a process that almost everybody that provides housing, if you're not up to those standards now, are going to have to do it by 2018. And we're going to, personally, people like myself, we're going to start doing that this year, because it'll take us 3 or 4 years to do that, because the cost will be pretty large, because we have to increase like our housing up to like 120 square foot per individual. The costs are going to be pretty high. I'm just guessing for our orchard that we have, I'm guessing right now our costs could be $50,000 to $60,000 to do these enlargements. So as far as just meeting these federal standards by 2018, this particular bill will be almost, I mean, if we don't have this bill, it's going to be very hard for people to get there. So thanks for your support.
Thank you. And we know that if you have to leave,
okay,
you have to leave.
So. That wouldn't be rude?
No, it's fine.
Okay.
We have a committee. I don't, unless there's a question here. Herman, did you have a question? Okay. Here, thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm here today to give an overview of Oregon agriculture and the importance of our critical partners in delivering high-quality, wonderful agricultural products, and that's our farm labor. In Oregon, according to recently updated figures from Oregon State University, Oregon agriculture represents about 15% of Oregon's economy, and we provide one out of every eight jobs in the state of Oregon. 2011 was a record year for Oregon agriculture. We broke the $5 billion mark in farm gate value. That's the value of agricultural products as it leaves the farm. And when you factor in everything that supports agriculture's contribution in Oregon's economy, it represents about a $28 billion economic footprint for the state of Oregon. Oregon agriculture is probably in the top five in the nation in terms of the amount that we spend on labor costs. Because of our diversity of Oregon agricultural products and the nature of, in particular, our specialty crops, so fruit production, vegetable, Christmas tree, nursery, we rely more heavily on labor than the majority of states in the United States do. And so for us to be competitive in Oregon agriculture, we have to have a high-quality labor supply and labor workforce to harvest our crops. A recent report from the State Board of Agriculture showed, in comparison to our neighboring states, Washington, Idaho, and California, Oregon has the lowest net farm income in comparison to those other states. There are a number of factors that result in that lowest in terms of Oregon. One of those is the cost of labor. We are the highest, second highest minimum wage state in the United States, behind Washington. So as I said, labor is not the only factor in there, but it's certainly a critical factor. And so anything that we can do to help either reduce or offset those high costs for Oregon agriculture will result in a more competitive industry for us. And just to give you an example, I had mentioned to you the net farm gate value in 2011 was $5 billion. The gross farm gate value was $5 billion. The net farm income, so the amount that actually goes to producers in the state, is just over $1 billion. So you can see there's a pretty high component of costs for Oregon agriculture. Interestingly enough, the amount that farmers and ranchers spent on labor $1.1 billion was higher than that net farm gate income that goes to farmers and ranchers. So that gives you a little context in terms of agriculture costs. We compete in a global marketplace. So we are not only competing with our neighboring states in terms of access to labor, but we are also competing in a global marketplace in terms of competitiveness with the cost of our products. There is an interesting survey that was completed in 2011 by the Washington Farm Worker Housing Trust that indicated 50% of the respondents that they surveyed indicated farm workers indicated they were looking to leave agriculture within the next year. However, when the question was asked if there was adequate and acceptable farm worker housing provided, how many of you would consider staying? And 91% of them indicated that good, safe, affordable housing was a key priority, and if they had that, 91% of them would stay in agriculture. I think that's a very good indicator of the importance of having farm worker housing and using that to help contribute to the competitiveness of Oregon agriculture. So with that, I hope you will use this information as you deliberate on Senate Bill 323 that's in front of you today. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks.
At a joint presentation here with one of my colleagues. Is it appropriate to have her?
Yes, absolutely.
Chair Roblin and the members of the committee, I'm Roberto Jimenez with the Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation in Woodburn.
And Molly McCarger with Pure Mind Farms in Jervis.
We also have with us in the audience Peter Handley of CASA of Oregon to assist with any technical questions, if you have them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We're here representing the Agricultural Workforce Housing Coalition, and we want to talk about the benefits to the state of our agriculture and our agricultural economy to rural communities and families of the Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit. We represent a long list of diverse supporting organizations from around the state, many of the members of the coalition here today. There are over 100 members in our coalition at this point. It includes the boards of commissioners from Clackamas, Jefferson, Washington, and Yamhill counties, and Chair Jeff Cogan of Multnomah County Commission. We're especially honored to have the support of former Governor Barbara Roberts, who says, and I quote, "I strongly support the extension of the Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit. This is a cost-effective tool that helps ensure families have a safe, decent place to live. It's a great investment for the state and the right thing to do for the people who put food on our tables." So we're here today to support Senate Bill 323, which extends the sunset of the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. We'll also soon be bringing forward our own bill and seeking amendments to Senate Bill 323. The primary benefit of the tax credit is to help create decent housing for farm workers. The Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit, renamed in our bill the Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit to reflect those that it accurately serves, has been proven an effective part of the toolkit since 1989. In 2011, we collaborated with three agencies, Oregon Housing, Department of Revenue, and Oregon OSHA, to respond to legislators' requests that we review and update the program. The credit passed through the House Agriculture Committee and through the Joint Tax Credit Subcommittee in 2011. In 2012, it passed the House Energy Committee and got to the Finance Revenue Committees. It had full hearings in both policy committees. We're also pleased to have the support of Governor Kitzhaber in recommending the extension of the sunset.
So our communities are better, stronger, and stronger.
You should identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
No problem.
Molly McCarger from Pure Mind Farms in Jervis.
Okay. Thanks, Molly.
I apologize. Like I was saying, our communities are better, strong, and stronger when they provide safe and stable, affordable housing for all of our residents. We don't have enough safe, decent, affordable housing for our agricultural workforce, and we know that we're only meeting a very small percentage of that statewide, and this leaves many families working, sleeping in their cars, under bridges, in fields and orchards. Or it also means that growers don't have a workforce available when crops are ready. We've had several occasions when this has been a problem. But there are three key reasons why this tax credit serves an important public purpose and deserves extension. It helps provide stable workforce to support our $5 billion agricultural economy. It stabilizes and creates jobs for both workers and construction and local services in the rural communities. And it also provides a safe, decent, affordable housing for the families who put food on our tables. If it weren't for these tax credits, our farm wouldn't have been able to build our current labor housing. And it also provided an opportunity for our bank to share in those tax credits when we built housing almost 20 years ago now. And we will be having to upgrade, like Senator Thompson was mentioning earlier, with the square footage.
A little on process, how the credit works. Oregon Housing and Community Service makes an annual allocation of credits available at the first of the year. Community-based nonprofit housing developers and farmers with eligible projects apply for the credit through a rolling application process. Credits are awarded, but cannot be claimed until the project is completed. Credits awarded cannot be used for more than 50% of eligible costs. Though it varies from year to year, on average, about 90% of the credits are allocated to community-based projects. Because community-based projects use large allocations of the credits, OHCS sets aside a small percentage for on-farm housing. By October of every year, if the on-farm credits have not been awarded, those credits are made available for community-based projects. Most of the credits go used every year and year after year. Your packet of materials contains more information there. This chart here just shows the usage of the credits over time. On average, about 90% of the credits are utilized for community-based housing. So why a tax credit rather than a grant? We often have the question on why a tax credit. As mentioned earlier, the tax credit works to leverage federal funding as well as private investment. The benefit of the tax credit provides through the leverage makes this credit a far more effective investment of resources than a direct grant. On average, say for one of FHDC's projects, in our most recent development, 20% leveraged $8 million in federal funding. For community-based project, the credit works to make USDA rural development grants far more competitive. The tax credit also encourages bank participation to invest in these projects. For a relatively small amount that is given to on-farm, the tax credit's most effective incentive. Agricultural employers generally apply the credit against their state income tax liability, if they have one. And there's no discount involved on the use of those credits. The credit can be only be used for 50% of eligible costs of new construction or rehabilitation, so the employer is only able to benefit for half of the cost of developing the housing. Nuevo Manacer is our primary project based in Woodburn. It's currently 90 units, with another 40 coming online in just the next few months. On average, we have about 300 families on the waiting list for that project. Nuevo Manacer was developed in four phases, as I said, two phases of housing, one with low-income housing tax credits and another with USDA rural development funding. The third phase is actually an educational center, and the fourth phase will be another 40 units of tax credit housing. So family and community support services at Nuevo Manacer include an early childhood literacy program, after-school programs, summer enrichment, adult computer classes, English classes, driver's education, and many more classes on a varying basis. Safe, decent, and affordable housing, and these services make the difference in the lives of residents. FHDC is closing on 100% graduation rate amongst our high school-aged kids. When you witness three-year-olds who've been through our early childhood literacy program and can recognize the alphabet and count up to 50. It's a pretty moving experience. Another project, Canyon East in Madras. Opened in 2011, developed by Housing Works, the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority. The project's funding included $300,000 of tax equity. Madras community and local economy, as well as the health and the stability of families, all benefit through this project.
Our farm has employees who live in Nuevo and Manacero and Woodburn, and without that, we're not sure where they would be, and we wouldn't have return longevity of employees. They come back every year, and it's because of this affordable housing that we maintain a consistent same bunch of employees, which improves everything on our farm. So providing housing for agricultural workers is essential to ensuring that this stable workforce is available. As growers, we need a reliable workforce. Broccoli and cherries don't wait. So when they need to be harvested, we need to have people there. And so housing plays an important role in this. If a grower or a community can provide housing to agricultural workers, it only assures crops get harvested, but it assures that the local economy benefits and that we all have fresh fruits and vegetables. About two-thirds of the units built are community-based and a third on farm, like ours and Senator Thompson's. Both types are needed, and both types are important. In dollar terms, the on-farm investment has averaged 13% of the credit amounts over the past decade. A small part of the program, but very much needed to help farmers make this long-term investment in their workforce. And since 2001, the credit has helped stabilize or create employment for more than 1,000 agricultural workers, 4,200 construction workers, and 100 local development professionals such as architects, engineers, arborists, surveyors, landscapers, etc. And in a 2011 analysis by OHCS found that $23.9 million in agricultural workforce housing tax credits were awarded since 2001 and has produced a net total economic benefit of $271 million.
Regarding the labor force, the average head of household living at Nuevo Manacero has five different employers over the course of a year. In order to keep the local labor force stable, it's helpful to have that community-based housing where mm-hmm. the families are not moving from camp to camp. The Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit provides partial but critical funding for affordable housing located in communities close to agricultural work. The tax credit mechanism works to leverage other resources, including federal and private sources, low-income housing tax credits, and USDA rural development funding. USDA also at times has rental assistance for families to help keep rents affordable for those in need. Recently, two local projects were awarded USDA funding, which leveraged $6 million in federal funds for community-based housing. By leveraging public and private investment in safe, decent, affordable housing, this tax credit helps keep workers and their families out of unacceptable, inhumane living conditions such as these. Nearly half of the housing that does exist was made possible by the tax credit. Affordable rental housing is often not available in the rural areas. Safe, decent housing means fewer people are homeless or living in inhumane conditions. Children's success in school and in life is tied to having a stable home. This is a labor camp here in Marion County. Dire conditions, unsafe, substandard, and inhumane. This tax credit provides an incentive and brings in additional federal and private investment. The alternative, community-based housing. safe, decent, affordable housing for Oregon's agricultural workforce and families is needed and should be preserved. Thank you again.
Questions? Yes. Senator Pazansky.
The slide that you showed just before that, is that unit still being used?
I don't know at this point. It's seasonal housing. It is generally used during the season.
I would hope not. That's not our farm.
I hope not, too.
I'll just clarify.
And I'd hope that there's some inspection that's occurring, because that seems pretty uninhibitable.
If it is.
Right. Correct. Yes. Senator Close.
Molly, would you just explain to me, how do you determine if somebody is a farm worker and qualifies for this housing, or people that just aren't farm workers? How do you determine that?
That's a good question. I know that when some of our employees are, give me paperwork to fill out for Nuevo Amanecer so that they can provide proof that they are working in agriculture. And I believe it's only 6 months. They need to be working in agriculture at least 6 months out of the calendar year. And I could be wrong. Peter would be best to answer that question. On our farm, it's pretty obvious because they're working for us, and I know all of their faces and names. But for housing, Roberto, they'd have to resort to Peter.
Follow up, yep.
So are you saying you sign off on a form, or how does that work?
Craig, they are Roberto would probably better answer what the form is, but it's basically I include they have their name and everything on it, and then I validate or verify that they have been employed with us and what their wages are and their average weekly income and how many hours a week that they work, and then fax that back to them, and so it's verified that way.
Thank you.
Senator Bereshit.
See, you're doing really good there, Senator Roblin. This question is for Secretary Kuba. Does this also apply to forest workers? A lot of them are guest workers. Does this apply to their housing too?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we don't have forestry in our portfolio, so I honestly can't answer that question for you, but I bet you some of the technical experts here could do that.
Okay, great.
Peter, do you want to come on up? And just identify yourselves.
Peter Hanley, CASA of Oregon, Sherwood. Chair, Senator, I'm not going to pronounce your name right, so I won't even try.
Senator Herman.
The tax credit can be available for agricultural and forestry workers, processing workers. I think the special issue with forestry workers, and I'm thinking more on the reforestation side of things, is those are mobile camps, and it's really hard to do mobile-type housing with this tax credit. We've contemplated it, but we've just never figured it out. We've even thought about buying some motorhomes and trying to run those, but we just haven't really cracked that nut.
Yeah, well, a lot of the companies put the workers up in the motels and stuff like that.
Right. But
there also are some fixed-based operations, too, and I just didn't know if it was still available to the forest industry.
Yes. Senator Pazansky.
Molly, if I can just follow up. I just want to clarify for the record. When one of these individuals who is going to be working for you is looking for housing, they're going to bring to you what I'm going to call a standardized form that's provided to them by the housing unit.
Mm-hmm.
You take it, you fill it out, and then instead of giving it back to them, it actually is transmitted back to them by fax. Because I think one of the potential questions is whether or not someone's going through the paperwork but actually isn't working. And I just want to put on the record that it seems to me you got a closed system to make certain that what's being verified is for someone that's actually working and it's actually going back to who needs it and it's not being misused.
Correct. The form is faxed over. I've only a small occasion had an employee, I think one time, bring a form in, but it's generally faxed over. I fill it out, and if I'm busy working and it sits on the fax machine, I get a follow-up call from the housing and to verify that I've received it and send it back.
I just want to put on the record that we do have a closed system.
Yep. Correct.
It's not going to be misused or abused.
Right. Correct.
And Senator Pazansky and Chair Roblin, before the investors put their money in the community-based housing, all of the residents are certifying that they actually work in farm work. So that's one check on the system, as well as when they apply for the when the investor or the farmer applies for the tax credits, they're also doing a certification form to the Department of Revenue.
So, a couple of questions. Did I hear you correctly saying there are some amendments that you would like to this bill, or?
Chair Roblin, we are introducing a separate bill, and which currently has a number of sponsors. The only amendment that we want to do is change the name to more accurately reflect the type of agricultural workers that we're talking about. We're wanting to change farm worker to agricultural workforce. That's the only change that we're proposing at this time to really recognize some alignment with the federal rules that call out processing work as an eligible activity as well.
Okay. Along that same line then, is sending this one to the CAC committee, or should we wait for your other one before we move forward? Any suggestions?
Sure, send it along. Chair Burdick will do wonderful things with it.
Okay. And then, let's see, what was the other question? Oh, we have this list of questions that we're supposed to get to. Do you see, in the foreseeable future, we have a timeline. We put another out there for a few years on this one, so it will sunset again. That we the need will be gone, that we will have actually supported it, or do you see this as an ongoing need over a longer period of time?
I see it as an ongoing need. We haven't been able to address but 1-2% of the needs statewide over the last 20 years.
Okay.
And Chair Roblin, I think we've maybe served 5% in the 20 or so years that the tax credit's been in place. Prior to the tax credit, there were maybe three community-based housing projects across the state, and you know, it's just been since the introduction of the tax credit that we've been able to go out and leverage the funds to really get what we need to get done.
Okay, so it is meeting its need. The tax credit is working the way it's supposed to work.
It is. I would really love to do a different job than building farm worker housing, but I'm committed to it. Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate that. Senator Bettsiger.
Would you have any opposition to using the language farm forest in naming this bill, since so many of our workers in the reforestation, you know, business, very similar, you know, to working in what on farms and stuff.
Senator Herman, Chair Roblin, I don't have a problem with it, but the definition already calls out forestry workers, and so we're really just trying to identify the group as, I mean, I consider forestry agriculture, and the definition of farm work includes that's the fact that there's two state, I don't want to address why there's two state agencies. It might, that's beyond me.
Senator Pazanski.
For clarification, Peter, what I thought I heard you say is the reason that you're moving this change is to conform to federal definitions or statement?
Our definition was changed a couple of years ago to include the processing workers. What we're just, this is more for appearance sake than anything.
Okay, that's fair enough. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all for coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we should finish this with a call. Next we have Ramon Ramirez, John McCauley, Ian Tolson, and Francisco Lopez from CASA. We should probably get one more chair up there if we could, since we're putting them in groups of four. Thank you. Just make yourself comfortable together. Yeah. Thank you.
I'll start off, Chair Roblin. For the record, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm a president of the Oregon Farmworker Union, PECUN. And also wanted to address the rest of the committee members. Thank you for having me, giving me the opportunity to speak. I'll be brief because I've submitted testimony, so you know, you can read my testimony. I just want to state our strong opposition. Not a strong opposition, but our strong support for Senate Bill.
You got our
I thought I'd be funny here. But we wanted to support the continuation of the farm worker tax credits for farm workers. Since our founding in 1985, Pecun has worked tirelessly to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers. I just want to acknowledge the photos that you've seen here are of labor camp that's in around the Woodburn area. And these photos were taken before the farm worker housing tax credits were created. I also want to acknowledge a group of farm workers who came early, got off of work early, and their families to be here. These are the people that will be directly impacted by farm worker housing tax credits. I wanted to acknowledge their presence here today. But over the last 30 years, we have worked tirelessly to improve the lives of farm workers, and part of that is also trying to improve the stock of farm worker or affordable housing for farm workers. Just in our county in itself, Marion County, we have a shortage of about 20,000 units just for the farm workers that we have currently. So the question is that I think we'll continuously be trying to fix this problem throughout the years. I have to say that I think that Oregon has some of the best farm worker housing in the country. It was mentioned that we only probably have, we serve about, 5% of farm workers in the state, but I got to tell you that it's become a model. So some of our housing agencies and the counties that built housing for farm workers have actually duplicated the model of the housing that Roberto Jimenez represents, Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation. In closing, I just want to say that the three things. One is that the farm worker housing tax credits has played a really incredible role in terms of the development and of Oregon agriculture. I think this is by passing this tax credits bill, you'll be sending a strong message not only to farm workers and the growers, but to investors that that this is a priority. This is a high priority for the state of Oregon. Two, I wish to invite you, each member of the committee, Chair Roblin, and the rest of the committee members, to not only visit the housing that we've built over the last 20 years, but I also invite you to go be witnesses to the labor camps and the labor conditions that exist. There are growers that have developed really nice housing throughout the state, but we still have a lot of problems. So I make that invitation to you. The last thing I want to say is that this is not only an issue of investing soundly in the state of Oregon. This is really a social justice issue, and correcting a long-term wrong that farm workers have been afforded through many years. And I think that we send a strong message saying, you folks pick the food that we eat every day, and you make Oregon prosper, and you count. And I think one way of doing that is by supporting the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, hi, my name is Ian Tollison. I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. We are up here today with the rest of the coalition in support of our effort to see the passage of this tax credit. It really is an important tool that will address the decent and affordable housing in and near Oregon's agricultural communities. Ag workers and their families will benefit greatly from the safe and decent housing that our farmers will provide for their workers. Just a few numbers. Oregon ag employers are ranked in the top five for employers that hire farm workers, and Oregon is top 10 producer of many of the ag's most labor-intensive commodities. That would include fruits, vegetables, and nursery goods. Both the on-farm and community housing that will be built from these tax credits will not only benefit my members, our farmers, but really the entire economy. This is an essential incentive for our farmers that really compete in a competitive marketplace that enables farmers to provide decent, stable housing. With that, the combination of the benefits that we provide, the housing that our farmers create and the jobs for the economy. We really would like to see this pass. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry today, and these are the growers in the Mid-Columbia area, Wasco, Hood River counties, as well as the growers in Umatilla County in eastern Oregon, all of whom support my being here with you today. And we are here to strongly support Senate Bill 323 and urge you to move it on to the Tax Credits Committee. If you look at a list of where on-farm projects are done, they are mostly done in the Hood River and Wasco counties. About 88.5% over the past 12 years of those projects have been done in those two counties. The growers there have made it a priority to provide decent working conditions and living conditions for their farm workers. This is a highly skilled workforce that works intensively for a very short period of time. And it is a mobile workforce, it is a seasonal workforce, and the housing that is able to be provided by farmers is critical to meeting those housing needs affordably for those workers. We believe that this is not only an economic issue, it's a humanitarian issue. And if we can utilize this tax credit to improve the housing for the workers, it is critically important in those two aspects for the state of Oregon. So we urge your continuation of this tax credit.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Francisco Lopez, and I'm the executive director of CAUSLA Oregon, which is the Oregon Latino Immigrant Rights Organization. We are one of the largest Latino organizations in the Pacific Northwest. You know, let me start by saying, another thing is I used to be a member of the State of Oregon Housing Council. I was appointed there by Governor Ted Kulongaski, and I served my term, and I was happy to serve there and make sure that the farm worker housing tax credits were utilized. Let me tell you the story why we arrived that we are. You know, in 1998, a group of church members from a Catholic church in Northwest Portland, St. Pius X Catholic Church, they started looking at the farm worker housing conditions. We went to a camp named Camp Azul in the Hillsborough area. And then trying to fix that labor camp, we came to the conclusion that more needed to be done. And then one day, a farm worker from Oaxaca, Mexico, there at the Camp Azul, told me, let's take this reality of the labor camps to Salem, to the capital. So in 1999, you know, my background is on electrical engineering. So when they told me, I just figured out, well, what you only need is a crane, a flatbed truck, and we lift it, we put it in a flatbed truck, and we take it to Salem. Well, here is the shack that we brought in 1999, put it right in front of the front steps of the capital, and the idea was to call attention to this issue. And I think we did, because, you know, we put the shack, and then Republicans and Democrats back then was Senator Kate Brown, Senator Castillo, Susan Castillo, and others say, well, we need to do something about it. The outcome of that year was $1 million to start farm worker housing and create a task force that will look into the farm worker housing tax credit. And then we look at other issues that we can expand it. You know, the Oregonian was worried, you know, with some lawmakers were worried, oh my God, the Golden Pioneer and the Shack will appear in the same photo. Well, it did in the newspaper. Not to embarrass the state, but basically to make a point. The need of farm worker housing in Oregon is not just the responsibility of the growers. And that's something that we say very clearly. It's everybody's responsibility. This tax credit, that I say call it, comes out of the struggle and the sweat of farm workers. So a yes vote would be to acknowledge and recognize all the struggle, all that hard labor. But this tax credit and this task force that was created did something else, brought all of us to the table. You will not even dream long time ago, before 1999, that group like the four of us will be at the same panel testifying in support of one issue. And the reason is because from everybody, the Farm Workers Union, CAUSA, the Farm Bureau, and other growers, we really care to do something about farm workers, not just recognizing their labor, but their housing conditions. And we were so happy to see at that time the state taking that responsibility and say, yes, it's not just the responsibility of the growers, but we all need to come in. So a vote yes for this will be a recognition, you know, of a tax credit that come out of the struggle of all of us. You know, I'm not usually advocating for tax credits, but the people that know me, but this one, this is different. And that's what I want to make sure that you all support this and make sure the passage of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? And I want to say thank you to you, and I do want to make it is nice of you to point it out, Ramon, that all of you that came today to be a part of your government, to be here in your capital, it takes an effort. You give up some work time, and you come here. We, as senators, truly appreciate you all being here. So, again, thank you for being a part of the audience here today. Even if you don't speak, your presence is really helpful. So thank you for that.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to translate that to them.
Okay.
With your permission.
That'd be great.
Él dice de que le da una gran alegría de que ustedes hayan venido, de que estén aquí presentes, de hayan tomado parte de su día para contar la historia del trabajo y de la necesidad de vivienda campesina en Oregon. Gracias.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you for wearing a tie with an apple on it. I
yes.
appreciate that.
So our next group, Eduardo Angulo, thank you. Bridget Cook, Alberto Moreno, and I think we have room for Roger Beyer. And thank you for helping me.
There's one more coming.
There should have been, but maybe not.
Yeah.
Who did I miss? Oh, Bridget Cook? Okay, very good. And whoever wants to start.
Chairman, Senator Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of you today. For the record, my name is Eduardo Angulo. I'm the chairman and executive director of the Salem Kaiser Coalition for Equality. Our member organizations are PECUN, the Farm Workers Union of Oregon, CAUSA, the largest pro-immigrant and rights coalition in the Northwest, Mano a Mano Family Center, Latinos Unidos Siempre, LUZ, our youth organization, Willamette University Latino Students, and our Oregon Parent Organizing project. All children deserve an opportunity to succeed in school and life, which is tied to having a stable home. Through the passage of Oregon Senate Bill 253, the 2011 legislature affirmed a clear and ambitious educational goal for the state. It is known as the governor's 40-40-20 aspirational vision, or the North Star, as many call it. It states that by 2025, all adult Oregonians will hold a high school diploma, 40% will have an associate's degree or its equivalent, and 40% will have earned a bachelor's or an advanced degree. What a lofty goal for all of us in Oregon. The passage of the Senate Bill 253 last year has created a new drive for action and change with a lot of hope in the migrant, immigrant, and communities of color throughout the state of Oregon. The fact that many of the thousands of children who are residents of the farm working housing developments around Oregon are English language learners, or ELL students, as we call them, and the governor and the state education leaders are committed to address their educational needs and bring them into the tent of education reform and equity, brings a renewed hope in our communities that all our children will have a chance to reach their full potential. For the past year, I have been part of a large group of leaders of community organizations of color as part of the Oregon Alliance for Education Reform or Education Equity, and you have a copy of our mission and our vision and all the organization members of this alliance that include the nine tribes governments of Oregon,
the NAACP, so Salem-Keizer, Corvallis, and Eugene, and Springfield, a panel, the Pro-Immigrant Rights Coalition of Pacific Islanders, Micronesians, and Asians, and all the Latino organizations that work to help our parents and our children with their education. We have been working as part of the solution to the growing achievement gap between students of color and English language learners and their white classmates. I am here today to express the united support of our communities for passage of Senate Bill 323 that will extend the tax credit for farm workers' housing around Oregon. Prior to the 2001 creation of the tax credit, there was not much decent housing for the farm working families and children around Oregon. Now we have more than 1,200 units built since 2001 thanks to the tax credit. It is important to understand that we have approximately 60,000 students in our public education system throughout Oregon, all spread around the 197 school districts throughout Oregon. As you know, those are the students that are the farthest behind. Many of these students are, the great majority of them, are American-born to Spanish-speaking families. We need more secure housing for the thousands of farm-working families and children who are waiting for them to be built so we can guarantee that more children live in a decent house will come to school every day ready to learn. We cannot expect to reach our 40-40-20 North Star aspirational goal by 2025 for all children if they don't have the most primary need covered, decent and secure housing. Please support Senate Bill 323, an extension of the Farm Workers Housing Tax Credit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and the Oregon Blueberry Commission. Both groups wholly support this tax credit, and members of the groups have used the tax credit in the past and look forward to using it in the future. I would also like to point out, though, that especially from the berry farmers' perspective, while this tax credit is important, there are still gaps in the housing needs for the workers in the short-term migrant areas. The dairy farmers is a little bit different situation. They are more full-time workers there where the full-time housing and full-time housing is needed. But in the dairy, in the berry world, I got my dairies and my berries mixed up there for a moment. In the berry world, we're talking about very seasonal employment. And many of the producers cannot afford to build full-time structures in order to house workers for 2 or 3 months in the summertime. So there is an unmet need that even this credit can't meet. But there are two issues, not just the finances. There's also a land use issue in this arena. There are many working families that would like to move around the not just Oregon, but California, Oregon, into Washington as the seasons progress from south to north and early to late for crop harvesting. And many of those families now have recreational vehicles or trailers they would move with them, but they have no places to put them during the season. And in Oregon, the farmers cannot, under land use laws, they cannot have them on their properties that way. So while it's important, this credit is vitally important, there's also a need to allow for parks. I mean, really, they would become parks or RV parks to be created on farms for uses of temporary housing to be brought in. The families typically own them themselves. They would move the trailer in, live in it on the farm while the work is there, then take their RV and they go on to the next spot. So I know this isn't the venue for that issue to be brought forward at this bill at this time, but I wanted to let you know as a committee that is a concern that's not, or a need that's not being met even by this important tax credit. So put it on your radar screen as another issue to look at as we move forward, maybe not this session, but certainly needs to be addressed in the near future. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, esteemed members of the committee, my name is Alberto Moreno. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I'm also the president for the Oregon Farmworker Ministries Board and the former migrant health coordinator for the state of Oregon. In that last capacity, I know that the state of Oregon has 174,484 migrant and seasonal farm workers in the state. 14,588 of those are children and youth, and 44,000 of those are seasonal children and youth. Their income, the income of an individual farm worker, is still about $7,500 per year. And so if you think about housing affordability, you can see that easily eradicates that budget if we're just talking about housing, much less health, much less schooling, much less clothing, food, et cetera, et cetera. What are the health conditions of this workforce? Commonly reported health problems among migrant farm workers and their children include lower height and weight, higher rates of respiratory disease, higher rates of parasitic conditions, skin infection, chronic diarrhea, vitamin A deficiency, accidental injury, heat-related illness, and chemical poisoning, to name just a few. In fact, the infant mortality rate among migrant farm workers is 25% higher than the general population. It is an untenable fact for us, and it is something that is difficult for those of us who work in this field to bear, much less the children and the families who are affected by that reality. Migrant farm workers are the most disadvantaged medically indigent persons and have the poorest health of any group in the U.S. That's according to OHSU. What does this mean? It means that the commensurate effect of these disparities on a human frame consumes to a life expectancy of 49 years of age for these farm workers. That's in comparison to 73 for you and I. A difference of 24 years, if my math is right, multiplied 174,000 times over in this great state of ours. What is one of the drivers of this limited life expectancy? Those housing conditions. And so it is for that reason that the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, that I in my role as president of Oregon Farmworker Ministries, ask you to support this extension of a tax credit. I was reminded as I walked through the Capitol doors of Oregon's promise to all of its communities. And that promise was so important that our forefathers carved it onto the stones on which this Capitol is built. And that is the equal and unabridged portion of those resources to all of our communities without exception. And so we look for your leadership. We hope that you can see your way to supporting this extension. It is in our mutual economic best interest, and it is the right thing to do. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions?
No.
Seeing none, thank you. Is there anyone else who didn't sign up who would like to speak to Senate Bill 323? Seeing none, we're going to close the hearing, the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 323. Senator?
Fairchuger.
Very good. You did that really well.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been practicing.
Yeah, you know, I'm finally getting it after 50-some-odd years. You know. Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Tax Credits.
Senator Bertschinger moves Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's unanimously passed. And do we need... Yes. Don't need a carrier. And we don't need to put a carrier on this one because it's going to another committee. So you can all come back when it's in the tax credit committee and make sure that they follow through with that.
Thank you.
So we already opened a hearing on Senate Bill. Get to the next one.
323.
Is that 224? Was he 24?
I supported it before. I was here in 1999. My last session before term limits.
So we're going to try to make our phone call again that we made a little earlier, and that's for Senate Bill 325. They're both open, so we'll look at, we'll start with 325, and we're going to go for our phone call.
take that person as a Polish Aggie.
Hi, Dr. Plant. This is Senator Roblin at the in the hearing for the Rural Communities and Economic Development, and we're looking at Senate Bill 325. And we're sorry we missed on the phone number at the earlier in the meeting. So thank you for being there. We are ready now. If you want to testify, be sure and let us know your name, and then we'll open it up for questions after you're done speaking.
Great. So I am Gary Plant, P-L-A-N-T. I'm a family physician in Madras, Oregon, with Madras Medical Group. I have been the here at Madras for about 8 years, and am also currently serving as the president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians for a couple more months, and am also a member of the Oregon Medical Association, and was asked to represent them as well today.
Thank you. So go far ahead with your testimony.
Well, the rural tax credit was one of the things that allowed me to be able to come to Madras and practice. As a rural family physician, we are expected to provide services outside the scope of many of those family physicians that are in more urban areas. For example, in Madras, we cover call for the hospital. Our group has provided ER coverage in the past, although we're no longer doing that. We do cover hospital admissions, obstetrics. A group has covered surgical services in the past, and yet we find that our incomes in rural areas, partially because of the payer mix, partially because of the number of uninsured patients, tends to be well below that of our colleagues that are in larger cities. And so the $5,000 rural tax credit has essentially been about 5 to 6% of my take-home pay over the last 8 years. Losing that tax credit would certainly make it more difficult to afford to stay in this community. And I have concerns about, in a rural area, we're always recruiting the next generation, the next doc to come along behind us, keep the practice going, and that is becoming increasingly difficult. The rural tax credit is certainly one of the tools that we use for that, in addition to longer payment opportunities, and of course we always in a rural community talk about lifestyle issues as well, and the beauty of our area.
Thank you.
I know.
Oh, yes. Do you have some more, or would you like some questions if we have any?
No, questions would be great.
We have one from Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Dr. Plant. This is Jenny Burdick. Do you have any idea of how many other people in your community? I assume you live full-time in your community?
Correct.
And do you have any other idea of how many others in your community are benefiting from this tax credit?
Sure. There are, there's six providers in the clinic where I work. There's four physicians, a nurse practitioner, and physician assistants. Mm-hmm. There are four providers in Mosaic Medical, which is another practice in our community. There's an internist in our community. I believe those are probably the only 11 providers taking advantage of the credit in Jefferson County.
And do they all live there full time?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
I misspoke. There's also the physicians that practice in Warm Springs, I would assume, are taking advantage of that. That would be another six providers in Warm Springs.
Oh, okay, and so, to your knowledge, they all live full-time in the practice, live and practice full-time in the community?
Correct. We do have specialists that come up from Bend, but they're only coming up once or twice a month, and my understanding is that they would not qualify based on the current rules for the rural tax credit, and they're only coming up one or two days a month.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? No other questions. Any more testimony? Dr. Plant?
Well, I'm going to assume that the committee has heard testimony from the Office of Rural Health.
We're going to be hearing from, yeah. We're going to.
Sorry?
You're our first person on this bill, so after you, we'll have the others.
I would just comment that the Oregon Academy received word from the Office of Rural Health that they had done a study where they'd queried providers in rural areas and asked them how this would affect, how losing the tax credit would affect their ability to stay in the community. And I was actually surprised. I've been here 8 years. I know certainly in the first 5 years when I was getting established in the community and trying to build my practice, it was really important to me. Now I have roots, and I feel like I would stay in the community, although it would be more difficult to do so financially without the benefit. But 70% of the people that responded to the survey said that they would either leave immediately or begin looking for other opportunities if this $5,000 tax credit went away. So I was actually surprised by that, and now feel more strongly that it's important that we keep this for the rural communities, especially our frontier communities that it's tremendously difficult to recruit physicians to. And if it would make that big an impact and communities would start losing their physicians, that's going to be very damaging to the medical systems in those places.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Well, again, thank you, Dr. Plant, for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And we're going to now have testimony from a bunch of other people. So you can either stay on the line and try to listen, or we can say goodbye. But thank you.
I'll probably get back to work. But thank you so much for taking time to listen.
Thank you. So we have a rule that people that come over 100 miles get preference. So the one person who has said that, is it Meg Portwood? Come on up. And we're going to do Senate Bill 325, and then we'll go back to 324. So 325 right now. We might as well get a couple other people. Scott Ekblad and Kurt, you can come on up too. Hilara. You get to start.
Oh, thank you. My name is Meg Portwood, Chairman Roblin and members. Thank you for allowing me to talk. I'm a family nurse practitioner in Lincoln City, Oregon. I have been there since, 1976. Yes, and I work in a primary care clinic. I am a designated rural health clinic, as well as a member of the local CCO out of the Samaritan system, which is helping to provide care to the Medicaid population. We are also a patient-centered primary care home, PCPCH, all those special initials. And we are our goal is to provide primary care to our patients. We see pregnant women, infants, complex problems, birth to death. I do not have official hospital privileges in my community, but I make social rounds to our patients when they are admitted, and the hospitalist returns care to us. This health credit is critical at our facility. I am on faculty at OHSU nurse practitioner program, as well as University of Portland, Gonzaga, and have had students from other places in the nation. And whenever I have a student with me, I really hit them up to come to the rural community to practice and provide care. We see people who are homeless. We see teenagers who have no homes. They live in the woods. We have people that live in low-income housing. We have people that will have 18 folks living in an apartment because they don't have housing. They have no insurance. The majority of our population are Medicare, Medicaid, uninsured, and underinsured. When I did my tallies for the electronic health record, supplement, 85% of my population are poor. And that means I don't get much income. And in order to keep myself in practice, this rural tax credit is critical. I did a poll of nurse practitioners throughout the state. I am a member of the Oregon Nurses Association, Nurse Practitioners of Oregon Group, and I am our regional rep. I contacted people in Coos Bay, Fossil, Halfway, LeGrand, and up and down the coast and in the valley. And to all of us, this tax credit is essential to keep our practices open. Recruitment and retention, as Dr. Plant mentioned, are just huge issues in our rural communities. And who's going to replace me? I don't know. You know, I've been trying for 20 years to find somebody foolish enough to, you know, be willing to work 15 hours a day on call 24/7. I have a nurse practitioner that works with me, but she only wants to work 4 days a week, and she likes to be off a lot, you know, so who's going to cover for her? Well, that's me. I haven't had a vacation in 3 years. So I really need to look for some help, but this tax credit is essential to us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kurt Higuera with Siskiyou Community Health Center in Josephine County. We're Siskiyou Community Health Center is an FQHC, federally qualified health center. We service all of Josephine County. I'm here to support Senate Bill 325 as it, we feel that it's an essential recruitment and retention tool for to hire qualified providers to service our rural communities. Recruitment has been an ongoing struggle for Josephine County for many years, and including the Illinois Valley, which is remote, very rugged, and very difficult to recruit for qualified individuals. I've had an opportunity to talk to all of our providers that qualify for the tax credit, and all of them actually said that that is what attracted them to the area, and that's what keeps them there as well. So I want to just add that please, for the purpose of providing high-quality care to remote and rugged and rural areas, move this bill forward so that it passes and we can continue to retain and recruit high-quality individuals. I'd like to add something else that one of our providers, one of our most senior providers, added in a comment for me, and it goes beyond just the recruitment and retention, but it also tells you a little bit about how this money goes back into the economy itself. Since this tax credit, it realistically means $5,000 back every tax season. For my family, this money that flows directly back to the local economy every year. Over the past 13 years, this money has helped me remodel my kitchen, bathrooms, countless other home improvement projects, helped to replace my sewer and driveway last year using only local contractors. And this year, it will go to a river guide for services for my family to take a look at the scenic Rogue River. When you multiply the times the number of medical professionals in this county, when you multiply the number of medical professionals in this county, and this is a lot of stimulus that the local economy, that flows into the local economy every year. Local medical providers, as individuals, are major sponsors of youth sports teams, arts organizations, and Josephine County community libraries. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Scott.
Thank you, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. And I'm here to give a bit of an overview of the tax credit program. It's administered by the Office of Rural Health, or at least the eligibility portion is. This program was developed in 1989, which was the same year that the State Office of Rural Health in Oregon was moved from the State Health Division to Oregon Health and Science University, which is where we are today. The first credits through this program were granted in 1990 to physicians, PAs, and nurse practitioners, physician assistants and nurse practitioners. And then the nurse anesthetists, podiatrists, dentists, and optometrists were added at different times in later years. I was not working in the field when the program began in 1989. However, I think it's safe to assume that the intent behind the program was to increase the availability of healthcare practitioners in rural communities. Since 1991, the number of physicians receiving the credit has increased from 538 to 1,237. The number of nurse practitioners and PAs receiving the credit have increased from 115 to 645 in that same period of time. we can assume that there's been an increase in the number of providers in rural communities. I'm not sure we can say that they're all directly related to this tax credit, but I think it certainly has something to do with the greater ease in recruiting and retaining providers in communities. Just over 2,000 providers qualified for the credit in 2011, and that represents $8.5 million per year, or about $17 million in the biennium. And as you know, there are two amendments, either drafted or being drafted, to
this bill. They're here. I haven't mentioned that to the committee, but and if you want to go through the explanation, too.
Sure. One would change the way the eligibility criteria are currently stated as far as time. The program, the way we determine eligibility now is that the provider must attest that 60% of their practice is spent, at least 60% is spent in a qualifying rural community. One of the amendments would change that to a minimum of 20 hours per week. The theory being that there are some partially retired people, for example, who only work 10 hours a week, but as long as six of those hours are in a rural community, they could qualify for $5,000 in state income tax credit. I honestly don't know how many people that is. I'm sure it's quite few. But this does clarify it a little bit more. The second amendment is to require that providers who receive this income tax credit must keep their practices open to a level of Medicare and Medicaid recipients equal to the level of Medicare and Medicaid eligible people in their county. I cannot predict what the impact of either one of those amendments will be on the number of people who qualify. However, I do have an interesting piece of information based on a similar amendment being made to the medical malpractice subsidy program, which our office also administers. And essentially from the first year of the medical malpractice subsidy program, where that Medicare Medicaid requirement was in effect, about a third of the practitioners dropped out of the program. Now, I don't think that was necessarily because they didn't want to see that many people. I think for at least some of those providers, it was that they could not really afford to see that same percentage of Medicare and Medicaid patients. What happened over time, and it wasn't just that one year, the number of people who get the malpractice subsidy has continued to decline over time. I think that some providers actually tried to keep their practices open and over time just realized that they couldn't and survived financially. So that is, of course, a bunch of subjective opinion on my part. There's really no factual way to find out if that was the case or not, but it is an interesting observation from the medical malpractice subsidy program. I can tell you that if the credit were increased, another idea that's come out is that if the credit were increased for those practicing in frontier communities, and those are the 10 communities on the eastern part of the state, 10 of the 36 counties are considered frontier, six or fewer people per square mile, that would be 228 people. So, for example, if we were to increase the tax credit from $5,000 to $10,000 per year for those practicing in Frontier, assuming they make enough money to claim $10,000 in state income tax credit, and I would bet that many wouldn't, then that would affect 228 people total. All right. I believe quite strongly that should this credit be allowed to sunset, we would see a precipitous decline in the number of providers in rural Oregon, and I believe that this trend would continue over time. And one of the reasons I believe that is because in the survey that was mentioned earlier, and I will go over the salient points of that survey, the people who are in the field see this program as even more a retention tool as they do recruitment. I think that it sounds great to get a $5,000 tax credit when you're thinking about where to practice, and that could certainly weigh into your decision, but I think that they have found after being there over time that it also is a very effective retention tool. So, speaking of the survey, and I'm just going to go over again briefly some of the important points. We did send out a survey, we being the Office of Rural Health and the Oregon Rural Health Association in collaboration, sent out a survey to all the people who are eligible for this program. And that would be people who, again, spend at least 60% of their practice in a rural community. Rural, for the purposes of this particular program, and it's different for each program, for this one it is 10 miles, at least 10 miles from a community of 40,000 or larger. You'll see, if you look at the slides that we gave you, there's a map showing the state of Oregon. Anything within the yellow boundary in that map would be areas that do not qualify for the tax credit. All the green areas, they would qualify for the tax credit. The darker green is frontier compared to the lighter green, which is just plain rural. There is a slide that shows the number of recipients and their breakdown according to profession. I'm going to have to apologize. There was a little snafu in printing out the slides. They came out a lot smaller than I had intended. But they add up to physicians being about 1,200 of the 2,000, and nurse practitioners and PAs end up being about 700, and the rest are the other professions involved. So we sent this survey out to 2,067 people that could potentially qualify. Not that high a number of people actually got the credit in 2011. That's simply because some people just don't get their paperwork in. But 2,067 would potentially qualify and had contacted our office for an application. Of that, 52% responded. We had over 1,000 people respond. So just that, a 52% response rate, as you probably know, is incredibly high. It's almost unheard of. And so that is, I think, a sign of how importantly people feel this program is for them. The next slide shows the breakdown according to licensure. Half of the people who responded were physicians. Of the people who responded, I would say about a third have gotten the tax credit for 11 or more years. So two-thirds have received it for 10 or fewer years. Of the people who responded, looks like about half said it's either important or very important. The third in order of most common response was that they didn't consider the tax credit in deciding to locate to rural Oregon. The next slide says, or asks, has the tax credit been more valuable as a recruitment tool or a retention incentive? And you can see that a great number of them, almost half, consider it a better retention tool than recruitment. We asked them how they would feel. Would you continue to practice in rural Oregon if you were required to practice a number of hours? And then we asked them how many hours would you consider reasonable? About 430 thought that 30 hours or more would be a reasonable requirement. About 400 said 20 hours, and about 150 said 10 hours. And so that's how I think folks came to arrive on the 20-hour minimum. Then we asked how they would feel if they were required to accept Medicare and Medicaid in the proportions that I talked about earlier, and about 900 felt that that would be fine. About 200 would disagree with that. As you can tell, this is a very important credit. We, in the end, toward the end, asked what would the impact be on your decision to continue practicing if the credit were limited to 10 years. In other words, you could only collect it for 10. After that, you're no longer eligible. About 750 said that it would either make them consider leaving or they would begin looking for other opportunities to leave rural Oregon. This is out of just over 1,000 people who responded. If the credit were eliminated, about the same number said that they would consider leaving or begin looking for other opportunities. So the vast majority actually of people who responded felt that this would be a real factor in deciding whether or not to continue practicing in rural Oregon. Our final question was open-ended, just asking for other feedback about this tax credit program. Of the 1,070-some respondents, 371 offered feedback to this question. The overwhelming majority reiterated the value of the credit, and many mentioned the fact that it lessens the urban-rural pay differential. And so, in closing, I would just urge your strong consideration of the extension of this tax credit program. I think it's very important to the people who are out practicing and taking care of our rural residents. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Pazanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, I just want to follow up. We had a conversation earlier in my office regarding legislation that's coming forward, and I'm not sure if we were able to come to an understanding as to whether in the city of Oak Ridge, I have only one provider there now, that's a PA. He told me at a town hall that there used to be three, the two have now left. When we're talking, I think we're just talking about different definitions of how, depending on what the program may be, how communities are defined as either being rural, frontier, urban. And could you, you may not know this now, but if you could get back to me, I would like to know whether or not for this purpose, for this program, whether that would be a community that would actually does receive the ability to have that assistance or not, because what I was told, at least under some definition, it's considered urban, even though it's 38 plus miles away.
Well, 40 is the number. 40 miles is the number, so if it's 38, it might, isn't it?
I don't think so.
10 miles.
No, it's 10.
Oh, it's 10. That's right. It's 10 miles outside. That's right. Okay.
And so I just want to find out, because I'm still trying to figure out what was the reason for two of the providers to leave that community, and whether it was economics, and if this would have been something that they were not able to take advantage of, but it sounds like they should be able to.
Yeah.
But I just want some clarification, please.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Pazanski. Any of the eligible providers that go to Oak Ridge could take advantage of the tax credit program. There's just no doubt whether or not it would be a qualifying community. And I really, personally, I've started to back away from even using the quote-unquote definition of rural, because one of my colleagues at the national level started going through federal statute, for example, and after he had found 60 different definitions of rural, he stopped looking. So we have several that we use in the state of Oregon, and sometimes for some programs we even use a combination of state definition and federal definition overlaying one another. So it's much easier to think about it in terms of geographic eligibility criteria for a particular program. For this one, it is being at least 10 miles away from a community of 40,000 or larger. And I know that particularly from people, the further east you go in the state, the more ridiculous that sounds. but when you start drawing circles around communities with a 15-mile buffer, a 20-mile buffer, a 25-mile buffer, you also start noticing communities that fall off the eligibility list that you know in your gut really should be able to take advantage of this program, because they also have difficulty recruiting. As for Oak Ridge, I think that it really boiled down to situations occurring simultaneously that at first you wouldn't think had much to do with each other. But I know that the problem with the change in the basis of the economy for Oak Ridge, in other words, the lessening of the impact of the timber industry, really took a toll on Oak Ridge and the income level of the folks who live there, the number of people who live there, and frankly the affordability of a medical practice in Oak Ridge. I think that as those providers retired, it was just impossible to find anyone to replace them.
Thank you. So.
Any other? Yes, Senator Britt.
Thank you, Mr. President. Where would you say is the greatest need in terms of attracting, what type of community has the greatest need? And I'm particularly interested in primary care, whether it be a physician or a PA or a nurse practitioner. Where would you say is the greatest need of the categories you have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I'm not sure I could really say. I would say that the smaller the community, the more it's impacted by the loss of a provider, because generally speaking, a family practice physician needs 2,000 patients for a viable practice. So if you're in a community right about that number, or even if, let's say you're in a community of 5,000, if you only have three providers in that community and you lose one, you already have an incredible shortage, whereas in a larger community, if you lose one, it's not that big a deal. So I'm also or I'm always most concerned about the smaller communities where there already is an infrastructure, how fragile that infrastructure is if even one person leaves.
Mm-hmm. And to follow up, what would be the impact, do you think, if we had a requirement that someone actually had to live in the community and practice there full time?
I think the impact would be twofold. I think it would impact the larger communities that are much closer to a metro area where the ability to commute is easier. I think it would also, however, impact the communities that do not have the population and therefore the volume to support a full-time provider. For example, we know that there are physicians in Baker City that travel and provide care to other communities around them. They don't live there, and their communities wouldn't support a practice being open maybe even 3 full days a week. But if they go and provide 1 day or 2 days, that would be a good...
But to follow up on that point, if you had a requirement that, you know, even raised the amount of time they had to spend, but they could divide it among several qualifying communities, what kind of impact do you think that would have?
Then I think that the impact would be minimal. Yeah.
Because I think what I'm trying to get, and I'll be seeing this again down the road, but is trying to, you know, the credit, everyone speaks well of the credit, and everyone says there's also a problem, which tells me, you know, if we've got limited resources, we should be trying to target them to where there really is a bigger problem.
Senator Burdick, we'd be happy to, any scenario that you would like us to come prepared with at the next hearing and to help you analyze that and get a better idea, we're more than happy to do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I can answer some of that based on my own experience with Siskiyou Community Health Center. Mm-hmm. The majority of our providers that qualify for the credit live and work in Josephine County, which is all rural. With the exception of one or two that probably commute from Medford, which is not considered rural. Now, given the opportunity that they could lose this this credit, my strong feeling is that they would probably move into Josephine County in order to keep that credit. The commute is very small. We're talking 30 miles, and so to enjoy some of the larger amenities such as Costco, 30 miles isn't going to make a big difference for a physician, but $5,000 a year will.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Any other questions? Never sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of just for the record, I just want to go on that I really do understand in Josephine County how important this tax credit is, especially out in the IV Illinois Valley area. You know, we've had times out there where we've had no community health care at all, and it's pretty rough on folks. So I just wanted to go on the record that I do understand in my district how important this tax credit is.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for introducing the two amendments. There's a third one that puts the two together in one, so we will consider that. I'm not sure we're going to take that action today. We'll probably bring this back because we have a few more people to testify. And I would like to have a thought about those frontier communities because I think they have a much bigger issue, and shifting it with some of the things we're talking about and giving them a little bit more might be a valid argument. So we'll have that conversation too. So thank you all.
Thank you.
And the last on this group, and then we have three on the last bill, Lee Hamilton, Jim Coffey, and Jody Weiser. Thank you. Who did we miss? So that's Jim and Jody and Lee Hamilton.
She had to leave to go back to Portland for a meeting.
Sorry about that. Okay, very good.
Okay, for the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So looking at this bill, there seem to be so many moving parts that could be moved. And I sent a list. I presented just the list, not really written testimony, quite a long list of options. we're cutting back on the education for the kids of these same communities. And so, you know, one of the simplest things is to say we've been cutting back on the teachers in the schools. Schools have been hit by more than 20%, so maybe we should reduce the tax credit for now to $4,000 instead of $3,000. But then I hear you talking about increasing it in the far out part of the state, which really does make sense when you know that there are people way out there that are trying to figure out how to get to a doctor, and getting into Portland isn't easy for everybody. But it's clear that most of the money is now going along the I-5 corridor, and that's not really a big issue. You know, somebody could live, a doctor could be living in Silverton because that's the life he wants, and be serving in Salem very easily. And likewise, a doctor could be living in Salem because that's the lifestyle he wants, and working in Silverton. I drive farther than that to get to my own primary care doctor because I really like my primary care doctor, and he knows me very well. And so, you know, the 10-mile limit is clearly not very appropriate, but since we see that the I-5 corridor collecting so much of the benefit of the program, and that's a population that's used to going to where the mall is to do their shopping and stuff. I mean, the whole idea of being able to get to an optometrist if you live in Pendleton is different than if you live in Kaiser. It's a very different proposition. So certainly we should change the definitions around who we will fund to make sure we're going where the need is. Also, we were looking at what kind of other benefits were available to medical providers in rural areas. And the federal government just came up with another big program that we're required to put additional money into. And so actually, if you are an OBGYN and you've left your study and you've moved to a rural community, you could be getting 80% of your malpractice insurance paid for by the taxpayers. You could be getting $35,000 worth of your college loans paid for by the taxpayers, and you could be eligible for this $5,000 tax credit. And that seems like an awful lot. And so the idea we came up with was to say there's a bunch of benefits. Choose the benefit that you want. Choose the benefit that works best for you, but you can't just pile them on. And that federal tax credits are the same as Oregon tax credits or tuition reductions or whatever. It's all taxpayer money, and it's all our taxpayer money. And so if you're using a federal benefit, that might disqualify you for a state benefit. And that kind of made sense when you looked at how many different things that keep emerging. And it's partly because there's a problem, and it's partly because everybody tries to solve it in a different way, and then pretty soon you don't know what you've got, but you actually have some layering of things going on. We came up with 24 hours a week because that would be 60% of a full work week. That's the way we came up with it. And then we thought it should also be expressed as 1,250 hours a year, since somebody might be leaving medical practice, or they might have a practice where they're in one part of the country part of the year and someplace else a different part of the year or whatever. So it just seemed like another way to express it. We learned that because different medical providers entered the program at different points in time, actually using different rules for different people, just within this group of providers, which is, I think, if I have it right, physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, certified registered nurse anesthetists, podiatrists, and dentists. And because we started with three, and then we added somebody else, and we added somebody else, and we added somebody else, the legislature created different rules each time. And so people who think they're going to be eligible aren't. And I noticed in one of the set of amendments, at least, there's a change, and it seems to be making it so people who are serving on hospital staffs are eligible, and they currently aren't, if I understand correctly. So I think you would want to look into that. It seems to me, having grown up in one of these towns where it was, in my case, 90 miles in any direction to another town. So that, you know, there was about 50-mile area that people came from. Once somebody came and was established in the community, if they were there and their kids had started to school, they never left. They just, you know, their commitment was there. You'll see people who kind of do the military model. You know, you get trained as a military doctor and you have to serve a certain number of years. And it's kind of the same. I got trained and now I'm going to go work in a rural community to take care of my debt. And that's, you know, that's just a practical thing that some people do. But I think you probably could easily limit this to a 10-year tax credit, and you wouldn't see people getting it for 40 years. Not many doctors actually practice that many years because they have so many years of training, but say 30 years of practice. It's probably not the deciding factor once they're really in the community. And definitely they should be serving TRICARE, Medicare, or Medicaid patients in proportion to those in their county. But they can't. I mean, like, you can understand why they couldn't keep their practice open, because you have to be serving as a percentage. It certainly makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Coffey. I'm from Astoria, Oregon, out in Clatsop County. I'm also the executive director of the Federally Qualified Health Center out in Clatsop County. And I came here with a really different sort of message I was going to give you about Senate Bill 325. And having listened especially to Kurt Higuera from Siskiyou talk to you, I'm not going to give you the same story about recruiting and retention and all of that. In Astoria back in 2001, Peace Health decided to pull out and essentially left a huge hole in the community with a very limited number of medical providers there, which I think may end up happening again with the rural tax credit sunsetting. At that time, the emergency room became the catch-all for everyone in the community.
Right.
And during our process of healthcare transformation with the coordinated care organizations, it is imperative to keep people out of the emergency rooms and keep them with primary care providers. I think that allowing this to sunset at this point in time is really a bad idea. I think having the ability to keep the providers we have in our communities, we're facing a really huge reduction in the number of providers already because of people beginning to retire. I know that in Astoria we're going to have probably 2 or 3 medical providers retiring in the next couple of years. So, and it is really a struggle. I'm really happy to say that OHSU is turning out really brilliant nurse practitioners, so that at least that type of provider is actually coming up in the world, is where the physicians have been shrinking for the last number of years that are coming out of residency, because unfortunately one of my own nephews decided to go into ophthalmology because it pays way better than primary care. And I spent 4 years while he was in medical school talking him into going to family practice. Didn't work. But anyway, it is really imperative that this should go on and continue, not sunset. And I really appreciate your time and the time of the committee.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Yes.
A question, I guess, really maybe for staff or for Senator Burdick. In your questions that you asked the doctor regarding where they live, resided, I was looking at the bill, and all it just extends the sunset is what the bill does. But is there requirements now as to them living and practicing in that community?
No.
No.
The requirements are very minimal in terms of how much they have to practice in a rural community. So you can literally have, I think the example was given, people going from Medford to Josephine County.
Right.
And they could go one day a week and still qualify. They don't get the full credit, but they could qualify.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just kind of springboard onto that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the Medford coming to Grants Pass? What's unique about that is some of the physicians, we can have somebody that is a specialist in Medford that actually comes to the rural community and brings his specialty to that community that really helps out in the rural community in our particular situation.
So thank you both. And is there anyone else that didn't sign up that wants to speak to 325? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on 325. And it's on our agenda for next time. I'm going to look into some of these issues, and we'll make some decisions if there's other things that we want to do, and we may have some other amendments.
Did you want to have some discussion about what we've heard as if you're going to be considering, or do you want to do that?
Yeah, I don't know if
this is scheduled for a work session, you could open it up just for a discussion.
That's true. We can do that then. Okay. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 325. And we have 324 open, and there are really two people left to speak on that one. So Scott Ekblad and, I guess it's three. Jim Coffey, you want to come back again? You can. Jim?
Okay. Lost Jim.
And Kurt Hagen, also from the Siskiyou chapter, if he wants to. Jim, back at this one. We're good. So it's just you. Yeah. No, not today. So you are. We already had one person testify, Louise, if you remember, our telephone at the beginning. So with that.
Oh, that's right. All right. Thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. In favor of Senate Bill 324. I'm sure that most people don't realize that once you leave the Willamette Valley, certainly once you leave the I-5 corridor, if you ever have a need to dial 911, you are most likely relying on a volunteer to respond. The more rural the area is, the more dependent on volunteers the local emergency response service is. I also don't think most people who live in urban areas where it's really an industry where there's actually competition for people to supply emergency response services, I don't think you realize that these organizations staffed by volunteers, the volunteers are also expected to do all of this not only on their own time but on their own dime. They have to pay out of their own pockets for the training, for the continuing education, for the uniforms, for the annual vaccinations, for the relicensure fee, all of that. And what the Office of Rural Health has heard over the years is that it's becoming more and more difficult, particularly as the economy is, during times when the economy is low and the dollar buys less, that these agencies are finding it more and more difficult to recruit volunteers. And so the Rural Volunteer, Oregon Volunteer Rural EMS Provider Tax Credit was created in 2007 to help defray those costs. This is a tax credit that is only $250 a year. But in order to get that, the person who is volunteering their time must be volunteering at least 20% of the time that they provide emergency response services. So in other words, they could work at a paying job as an EMT and then go to a smaller neighboring community and volunteer, and as long as their 20% of their time is volunteer, they could get up to $250 in state income tax credit. For the purposes of this program, the geographic eligibility criteria, notice I'm not using a definition of rural, is at least 25 miles from a community of 30,000 or more. The difference between 30,000 and 40,000 essentially excludes Grants Pass. That's the primary difference between 30,000 and 40,000. Of course, being 25 miles away excludes a lot of people. In 2011, the state adopted national licensure terminology for emergency medical responders. And as a result, what we used to call first responders, kind of the first rung in the ladder of emergency medical responder education and training, are now called emergency medical responders. We have come back to the legislature a couple different times asking that first responders be added to this program, because at the time it was just the three levels of emergency medical technician, EMT, basic, intermediate, and paramedic. Since the adoption of the national terminology, those folks are now called emergency medical responders. And so legislative council has let us know that emergency medical responders, formerly known as first responders, now qualify for this credit. So one of our goals has already been accomplished, apparently. But the fiscal impact of this program is currently about $300,000 per biennium. It's very difficult to estimate what the impact will be of inclusion of emergency medical responders, primarily because we really have no idea until we send out applications how many of these people are volunteering versus how many are paid, how many are certified such because they're on a police force or because they are part of an industrial crew. In other words, they're EMRs for the purposes of their employment. So we don't really know how many are volunteers. But in closing, this is a very small incentive for those who sacrifice so much for our health and safety in an emergency. However, we may be losing ground. As I looked over the data on this particular program, in 2008, just over 600 volunteers received this credit. In 2011, 524 received the credit. So I'm afraid we're beginning to lose volunteer EMS personnel in our rural communities regardless. And so I believe that not only should this program be continued, that it actually should be increased in value and possibly extended to include volunteers in less remote areas of the state. I thank you for an opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, just for the record, I just, you know, being from a rural community, I have a lot of friends that volunteer with these rural fire departments, first responders, and we need to keep it in our back of our mind that these people donate all their time. They donate their time for their training. And, you know, it's amazing their little network. I mean, they will talk to each other and say, look, you know, I'm going away for this weekend. Are you available for this weekend? And there's all these they're always looking out after the community and making sure that there's somebody there to respond. And it is no pay most of the time.
Yeah. And the other one I would mention that I think a lot of my friends that visit these rural areas from the cities don't understand is what you mentioned earlier. They're used to having medical facilities and medical people close by, and they go camping out in our woods, and all of a sudden there's an event, and they say, what do you mean it's going to take 20 minutes to get somebody here, or 30 minutes, or an hour? And if the fog's down, they can't get the helicopter in, it might be a little longer, and then the people that show up, they saw in the service station the day before, because that's the guy who's doing it. So, I mean, it is truly a different thing. They provide an amazing service, and I will look at this with regard to whether it should be increased or whatever, and I am a little nervous hearing it going down, because they are the backbone of the emergency service providers in our rural areas, and all Oregonians want them to be well-trained and to respond quickly when they need it in those rural areas. So, yes, Senator Burdick.
As co-chair of the Grinch Committee, what do you think would be the impact of maybe increasing the credit, but in also increasing the number of hours required?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would be happy to try and look into that a little further. Again, this is a program that doesn't use minimum hours as part of the criteria, simply percentage of the time.
Percentage of time,
yeah,
right.
Simply the percentage of time mm-hmm. that they provide emergency medical services, 20% of it has to be volunteer. And that was mm-hmm. In order to capture the people who do this as a profession somewhere else, mm-hmm. Maybe in a neighboring community, but they volunteer when they're at home. One of the more difficult scenarios for rural EMS services are those communities where the volume is so slow that it's so low, relatively speaking, I should say, but it's still equally important to have a 24/7 response, and in order to keep and also the ability to keep skills up for when those calls do come in. And so that's why the low volume volunteer, so to speak, I think it's important that we don't accidentally exclude them.
And you're also talking about oftentimes the amount of time they put in training is much more than the time they put actually doing the service, because they train regularly and then they intermittently have to go out on a call. So you have to consider all that time as volunteer, because it is.
And then a school bus slides off the freeway.
And then, that's right. And then that's all you have there.
Agencies from the four surrounding communities all have to respond at the same time, and you better hope that their training's up and their licensure is all current. And
sure. Okay. Well, I thank you. This is one that we will be carrying over to our next meeting, just to, if we're ready for it then. But it was not listed. The other one, 325, was listed on next agenda. This one we will carry over to the next agenda, so it will be there for our meeting. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 324. And I thank everybody for being here. We used all of our time in a little bit, so... Again, thank you all. Is there any questions or concerns or thoughts before we leave? Hearing none, we will adjourn the Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Thank you.